pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation to speak. I'm a bit nervous because in preparing for the talk, I'd lost some confidence in our results. So I'm not sure that actually the end result is right. But so let's start with some story instead. So Michael Fish and I are half brothers, in the sense that Michael Fisher was a student of my father's. So I think he set his own research direction pretty fast, isn't that right? Nonetheless, he maintained contact with my father, and he was visiting sometime, I think I was an undergraduate or maybe just finishing high school. But it was vacation time, so I was at home. And my father asked Michael what physics book I ought to be reading. And Michael recommended some book on the Ising model. I think it was probably Amit's book, is that
well,
plausible?
Eugene Stanley's book, I think.
Oh, okay.
That was it.
Yeah.
I forgot.
So I looked at it, but I couldn't make much sense of this statistical mechanics stuff. So I must confess I didn't get very far. On the other hand, it turned out I did my PhD thesis on renormalization. And then subsequently I thought, well, you know, in dynamical systems context. But subsequently I thought, well, you know, this renormalization statistical mechanics that was referred to in this book somehow ought to connect and I ought to do something about it. So over the years since finishing my PhD, I've gradually reinterpreted what I did in my PhD in statistical mechanics language. And the latest phase, and extended it, because you start asking different questions in that context. So the latest extension is with a student, Nuno Catarino, who we looked at the quantum statistical mechanics. So let me tell you the story. I'll have to start at the beginning, with the classical situation, and even at zero temperature. And we'll build on, we'll add temperature, and then we'll add Planck's constant. Okay, so Franco Kontorova, as Pavel just told me I should pronounce it, model. We have a sequence of positions. It's all in one dimension, so from point of view of statistical mechanics, it's maybe regarded as trivial. On the other hand, it has highly non-trivial fixed points whose existence has only recently been proved essentially by Koch in the dynamical systems setting. So X is some sequence of real numbers. Think of those positions of atoms on a line. And we can also give them momenta along the line. And we have an energy for the sequence of x's and p's. P squared over 2m. And some potential energy. And the potential is a sum of nearest neighbor terms. So I write it as some h of x sub n plus 1. And h is assumed to have the property that x h of x plus 1 x prime plus 1 is equal to h of x prime. We have a periodicity. If we slide two neighboring atoms by one spatial period, which I scale to 1, then we get the same energy contribution. And it has a convexity condition, the mixed second partial derivative is supposed to be less than some constant, less than zero. So the basic example from Frenkel and Kontorova is that W, or H, it's really what, yeah, this board slips, by the way, H of X and X prime is some spring energy with, say, natural length A, plus some energy, I'll write like this, say, cosine of 2 pi x. Okay, you can symmetrize it if you want and make this a half cosine of 2 pi x plus a half of cosine 2 pi x prime. That's the basic Frenkel contour of a model. And by scaling, it's really only the ratio, which I denote k, of u to l, so lambda, that's important. So for dynamical systems people, since I understand part of the idea of this semester is to see what interplay there can be between development of renormalization in dynamical systems with that in mathematical physics. So for dynamical systems people, then of course the critical points of this, P is rather trivial because it doesn't enter anywhere else, so P will just be zero for the critical points. So if you think the equilibria of this Hamiltonian system, the equilibria are in one-to-one correspondence with orbits of the so-called standard map. Right? If we make this sum stationary with respect to sequences, then we end up with a second-order recurrence relation for the Xn, and that's known as the Taylor-Cherenkov or standard map. Okay. Now, step one is what I'll call minimum energy renormalization. So this is building on theory of Aubry for minimum energy states of Frenkel contour of a model. So minimum energy states, these are configurations X, X is a sequence, which are minimizing W with respect to all variations of compact support. Okay, so we take a configuration. I draw it as balls and springs, etc. I'm going to say it's minimum energy configuration if whatever m at this side and n at this side we choose, then if we do variations of all the positions of the atoms in between M and N, then the state we've chosen minimizes the energy. Okay, with everything else outside being fixed. That's minimum energy state. And then we need a concept that I call physical minimum energy state, which is a subset of these. So here we want to minimize W with respect to all variations of compact support. But plus allowing to shift the ends by integers in the x variable or the n variable. Okay, so what I mean is that maybe we clamp all this side, but this side will move the whole of the chain one period in the potential and ask if what we've got is still minimizing with respect to making these choices. So Griffith has some word for this, I can't remember, some different word, but had the same idea. And that's a selection principle because there are lots of minimum energy states. There's a non-trivial set of minimum energy states for every choice of mean spacing. Okay, so maybe I should say first, minimum energy state implies there's a well-defined mean spacing. And Aubry proved that, and he proved that for every row there exists a minimum energy state of mean spacing rho. Plus he described what the set of such things looks like. Yes.
So are O'Brien's things simple?
O'Brien proves the existence of a set of minimum energy states for each mean spacing, and then he proves that this extra criterion selects one mean spacing. And the choice that's selected depends, the mean spacing depends continuously on parameters of the model. But typically with steps at every rational, okay?
You fix the mean spacing, you fix your density, then you minimize over.
Yeah, an equivalent way to say would be, let's find these minimum energy states, then let's look at the average energy per atom. That turns out to be just a function of the mean spacing of the minimum energy state. And then we minimize with respect to the mean spacing, and that will give the physical one. That's actually the route O'Brien took. This way is Griffith's way of saying the same thing. Okay, so the result of O'Brien's theory is that if we, for example, think about parameter plane for Frankel contour of a model, this way I'll put the natural length of the springs, and this way I'll put this ratio of potential to spring constant. Then we get regions with some given mean spacing. So here it'll be 0. I'll write as 0 over 1. And here we'll get 1 over 1. But coming out of natural length equal to a half, we'll have a tongue where the mean spacing of the physical minimum energy states is a half. And out of every rational, get a tongue. Okay, so this is O'Brien's devil staircase. If we fix k and just vary a, we'll get mean spacing as a function of a is flat at every rational and yet continuous.
So it's like Arnold tongues, right? Or is it really?
Yeah, it's O'Brien tongues.
Yeah, O'Brien tongues.
Mm-hmm.
But are they similar or?
Similar, but there isn't an underlying circle net generating them, so it's not the same mechanism as Arnold tongues. Yeah, so for if we just have a single cosine as here, then actually the order of the P over Q tongue, the order of growth here is Q has a K to the Q over 2 or something like that. Yeah, so I didn't draw this very well. This one actually comes out with quadratic. Mm-hmm. But if you put in a full Fourier series here, then they'll all come out linearly initially. So that's not an important feature for what I'm going to talk about.
The special function there is related to having single cosines, not having other harmonics.
Yeah, the fact that these come out like k to the q. Yeah, I guess it's k to the q, right? So the distance here, the width in A for the Qth tongue looks like some constant, of course, depending on P over Q times K to Q. That's the consequence of having a single cosine. Q is the P over Q here, mean spacing. Right, so I haven't written, but ME implies a well-defined mean spacing. It exists, I'll call it rho, equals lim xn over n, if you like. And this exists. No. Mean spacing varies continuously. So actually it goes through irrationals. Awesome. So that's the next thing to draw. So that tells us that there has to be at least a curve, and actually typical families it's just a curve. There's some curve. If we choose, say, 1 over golden ratio is my favorite number. Golden ratio is 1 plus root 5 over 2. So this is just golden ratio minus 1, if you like, just to shift it so it fits in this picture. Then there must be a curve where the mean spacing for the physical minimum energy state is 1 over golden ratio. And actually under some generic conditions, on the model, it is indeed not a curve, not a fattened thing. Oh, it depends again. Obviously, if I crossed out the cosine, it'd be soft, and the width would be zero. But generically, there's a width, yeah. Okay. So, this is incommensurate structures, as you'd call it, right? So the physical minimum energy state is an incommensurate structure. And what's interesting is that by thinking, I think this is how Aubrey approached it, by thinking of the dynamical systems story, we have standard maps, so it's an area preserving map, so we have KM theory and things like that, then he deduced that there must be, for small k, then this incommensurate structure must be able to slide. So it's sliding at the bottom, and then for large k, I'll draw it dashed, it must be pinned. Okay, so there must be some transition in between. So I'll just draw the transition as a single point, because that's the simplest way you could suppose it happens. And indeed, we believe it does happen that way for a large class of choices of this function h, though not all, actually. Okay, so what this means is that actually the minimum energy state, Aubrey proved, xn is equal to some function, call it big X, of n times the mean spacing plus a phase. So suppose you're looking for the minimum energy states of a given mean spacing row, then they're all of this form, where X is monotone, but not necessarily continuous. So really one has to think of two realizations of this, a left continuous and a right continuous version. I include that in the phase, right? So I can, the phase actually is a member not just of a circle, but of a circle with right and left limit points at every point. Okay, but the sliding phase is when this x is continuous. Indeed, if we have analytic function h in the sliding regime, it will be analytic from KM theory. And the pinned phase is when x is discontinuous. So it has jumps, and if rho I'm supposing is irrational, then it has an orbit of jumps, at least one orbit of jumps. And that's the context which Percival invented the name Cantorus. So maybe I should write this over here. So sliding corresponds to KM circle, and pin corresponds to Cantorus. Okay. And so Aubrey discovered that there must be some transition between these. Yes?
Just a question. So x can be any function, or is it function?
No.
Can you compute from the h?
Yes, but you can compute from the h.
Can you compute it? I mean, can you write it down?
No. No. No, it's the subject of KM theory. So KM theory, if you like, gives an algorithm for computing it, provided this parameter k is small enough in terms of an analytic function, so you could say Fourier series with exponential decaying coefficients. And for k large, so this pinned regime, then again there's something which Aubrey christened the anti-integrable limit, which is k is infinity in this model, and there you can do some perturbation theory and get much more explicit formulae actually for this. Well, down here, the small parameter is k, and up here it's 1 over k. Yeah. Okay, so this is why Aubry said, well, there must be a transition, and he called it transition by breaking of analyticity, which makes a great title for a talk. It means you never have to announce your... yes, there's that too, I'm afraid, yeah. Yeah, there is. Okay, because x changes from analytic to something that's not even continuous. It's got jump discontinuities in the dense set.
So for large k, it's true.
Yeah. Yeah, that comes from our theory of the anti-integral limit. So we have this TBA. I think it's better to call it deepening transition, and it's clearer what's going on, right? It's really a transition between where the physical minimum energy states are free to slide and where they're pinned. Okay, so this is background on our Frenkel contour model. So what about the renormalization? So here I'm going to reinterpret what I did in my thesis in the Frenkel contour language. So we have W, which is a sum of H's, xn minus 1 and xn, and xn, xn plus 1, plus dot dot dot. So what we could say is, well, we're trying to minimize this, so why don't we just minimize over some of the x's, some of the xn's, like here, right? Xn only enters in these two terms. So we could suppose we've got the rest of the chain in some state, and we'll minimize. Okay, so there's a decimation scheme, as you'd call it. And what are we going to do if we minimize over the chosen xn? Well, we'll just replace the original model by something that has all these h's still. But this is going to be replaced by something I call h plus h of xn minus 1, comma xn plus 1. And then there's all the other h's. So I've generated a model that has two types of bonds, right? So I refer to the functions H as bond energies, because it's not just from the springs, it's to do with where the ends are as well. So the Frenkel contour model, in this form, it only depended on the spring part plus where the left-hand end was. Of course I'm going to do it for much more than just one. I'm going to choose Fibonacci rules to decide which ones to do, because I'm interested in one over golden ratio. Okay, so I end up creating two types of bonds. Yeah, but as you say, what we should do is we should choose. So choose to decimate by the following rule. So I'll take zero on a circle and one over golden ratio, and I'm going to take n times rotation plus an arbitrary starting phase. Okay, so I'll start as a starting phase. So rotation number is one over golden ratio. So then I'll get round to here somewhere, then I'll get round to here, etc., etc. And I'll choose to decimate whenever I land in here. Okay, so this generates a new Frenkel contour model with two types of bonds. But the advantage of choosing a Fibonacci decimation like this is that then I can do the same thing again, and I'll only generate two types of bonds at each step. So we're going to get a closure. We're not going to find that every time we decimate again we'll generate more types of bonds. We'll only generate two types of bonds. Yeah, so I minimized over xn, so I get a new effective bond between xn minus 1 and xn plus 1, which has a different formula from the others. Yeah, so if I start with, I'm going to call them upsilon bonds, and I've relabeled the indices here, and tau bonds, then I'm going to have the property what shall I draw next? Yeah, I'll probably write the wrong thing, so let's not write it. But I'm going to have the property that this rule for deciding which sites to decimate over is only going to generate two types of bond after the decimation.
You're then going to have to join two of the...
Yeah, so these occur... Maybe I wrote in my notes because I always misremember which convention I take, but anyway. So in this, we only get upsilon plus tau and tau's on their own.
So the upsilon ones, they get modified and the tau's...
Yeah, but we relabel.
Yeah,
okay. I interchange the labels each time.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Periodicity condition is going to be lost. And that's an essential aspect of this approach. But it's preserved in an interesting way. It's preserved in commutativity condition. Okay, preserved in this commutativity condition. That's the remnant of the periodicity assumption. And that's enough, actually, to... Right, so the original thing, what does periodicity mean? Well, we can think of it as meaning that if I defined, say, tau was just h of x and x prime, maybe. Actually, I'm not sure this is the way I usually do this. Anyway, let's do it. And say this. There's a way of making two bond energy functions out of the original model. All I've done is to change my mind about my coordinate for the position of the final atom here. I've subtracted one from it, but it's just another class of the same models. That's because I'm going to end up wanting to do some scaling in x. So I'd like the x's to end up staying near the origin. Whereas, you know, if the mean spacing is something non-zero, then the x's go off to infinity. So this is how to get started. And so my decimation scheme is going to produce tau prime is going to be this upsilon plus tau. I use twiddle for the image under renormalization, actually, because prime I often need for a derivative, not at this stage, but, well, also I use prime here for the second. So I use twiddle just to avoid. And the upsilon is the upsilon twiddle is just the tau. Okay, so this is the decimation scheme, and...
Well, yeah?
Yeah, the intermediate point. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and with this rule, we never leave the space of pairs of bond energies. So as I said, it's sensible to look on smaller scales in X. And also, it's going to be sensible. So I'm going to compose with something alpha here. Okay, these are the functions of two variables. I do alpha, 1 over alpha in both variables. And I'm also going to scale up the bond energies by factor J. So I'm going to choose these in order to enforce some normalization conditions. The usual thing, we can multiply the original energy by anything and it's going to have the same minimum energy state. It doesn't change anything. So I feel free to multiply by something just to enforce some conditions so that this pair doesn't somehow wander off to infinity or to zero or something. Just stays in it. And I'll scale in X. That's because I know that if I'm looking at one of these minimum energy states with some mean spacing golden ratio, then the decimated sites are actually the ones that are sort of far from the origin. So I'm going to end up with all the sites I keep are going to be in some interval around the origin. And if I decimate lots of times, they'll be in a shrinking interval. And I want to keep track of how that interval shrinks, because that's one of the interesting things. So I'm going to blow it up to some standard length. So that's what the alpha's for. Okay, so this is the renormalization. Well, almost. There's a few other things to take care of. Turns out that we'd better add some constants. Otherwise, multiplying by J may still make things go to infinity, but adding a constant to bond energy doesn't change anything, as long as you use the... we have to use some appropriate multiple of the same constant for each of these. And we can also add co-boundary. Right? So a co-boundary means some function of the form C of X prime minus C of X, because that doesn't change the energy of a long sequence, because it's a telescoping sum. All it does is change what we do at the end. So it doesn't change what are the minimum energy states, and it doesn't change their average energy or anything. So we feel free to add a co-boundary. And it turns out that I have to do that to eliminate some unstable directions under renormalization. So here's the renormalization operator. And the great thing that I found is that it has, numerically anyway, a fixed point. And this fixed point corresponds to the depinning transition. Yeah. No.
You actually have to pick the co-boundary and go along.
No. Yeah, what I do is I the co-boundaries that I turn out to be enough to eliminate the unstable directions are well, constant co-boundary. C constant doesn't do anything because it cancels. So we have a linear one and quadratic, and that's enough. Something
linear in P of X, right?
No, linear in X.
Linear in X.
Yeah. So I only need a finite dimensional space of co-boundaries. This is a technicality. It's sort of first pass. You can gloss over it, but you've seen it before, so you have your right to have a second pass. Does it?
Is it adjusted so that you kill some term in the in your first?
Yeah. Yeah, so I choose it just to make, for example, derivative of this at, say, 0, 0 to be something, and the second derivative to be something else, but just to kill growth in this unstable co-boundary direction. Or you can leave it in, you just find the fixed point has some more unstable directions, but some of the trivial ones, then shouldn't really, better to take them out at the beginning. So what is the conclusion? Well, we find this picture. As I said, there's a fixed point that corresponds to the deepening transition, and in the space of these pairs, upsilon and tau, well, actually, I'd better do something about this commutation condition. It's not feasible to enforce it exactly, but again, I enforce it to some order in Taylor expansion about some point. Again, to kill some unstable directions that would be a nuisance otherwise. Of course, they could be interesting, right? Suppose you made a material that was incommensurate structure extrinsically, right? So you just decide to put silicon and germanium in some Fibonacci order or something. Then you wouldn't necessarily have the commutation condition, and so the unstable directions would be interesting. But yeah, but this is the space. I've got an operator now on the space. Okay, I start with, this is motivation. I start with an H function. I make an upsilon tau, and then I apply this operator. But, you know, why was I interested in exactly the Frankel-Kontorov model to start with? I'm not really. I'm interested in the whole class of things that look like it. It's just as you would do in statistical mechanics. Right? So you're not really interested in the Ising model. You're interested in the class of things that somehow converge to the same fixed points or whatever. No, I'm just explaining that I don't need to.
So that kind of a sort of period, isn't it?
Yeah. Because I could start with a class of materials which have an extrinsic incommensurate structure. Like I put a Fibonacci sequence of silicons and germaniums.
Just cut down your face, I don't want you looking at it.
Yeah. So I'm going to draw the picture where I've killed the non-commuting directions. But it is interesting, you know, I mean, and okay, so it's got a fixed point, and it's got one unstable direction. The eigenvalue is delta, which I'm very proud of because I reckon it's my number. There we are. Leo Kadanoff nearly got to this stage with Schenker. Yeah, I don't know if Leo's here yet. No. But yeah, Leo Kadanoff nearly got to this stage with one of the Schenkers. I forget, is it Scott Schenker? Oh, anyway. But he'd sort of implicitly assumed delta was golden ratio, so he didn't bother actually measuring it. And I commented on their preprint and said, there's no reason it should be golden ratio, I'll go and measure it. And there it was, and it wasn't. Right, golden ratio is 1.618 something. 339? I don't remember. And all other directions are locally attracted to this fixed point. It's actually got another fixed point down here. That's what I call simple fixed point. That corresponds to where there was no potential in the Frenkel-Kontorov model. And this is one you can write down exactly, explicitly what it is. You can do the spectral analysis, and you show it's attracting all the eigenvalues under renormalization as powers of plus and minus golden ratio. Yeah. Yeah. And in some sense, there's another one off to infinity, but I've never managed to make mathematical sense of it. The anti-integrable fixed point. It sort of attracts infinitely fast and there's something, I don't know how to make mathematical sense, but still a challenge. And, okay, this is a numerical, based on numerical work. Plus, you know, then I just implemented this operator with, in some space of polynomials of degree 18 and truncated. I had to choose, the, you know, I had to choose clever domains about which to center them to make sure there was a chance that the operator would be analytically improving in the neighborhood of where I was interested. But I managed to find them. That was really quite delicate. And so I got the computer to find a good approximation to this fixed point of some 18th degree polynomial.
So when you say you don't have full control of 1 upon k, but you do know there's nothing in between?
Numerically, yeah. But, you know, it's part of the, what remains to be proved, right? Even proving that this thing goes into there is not yet done, as far as I'm aware.
Are there now zeros that tell you that this fixed point?
Yeah, so this fixed point exists if you reinterpret some work of Hans Koch, who's here. That's Hans. Yeah, so... yep. So this is the picture. So it means if you take something like the Frankel contour of a family, it's the parameter k, it does something like this. And, well, it'd be nice to prove it crosses this stable manifold transversely, but numerically it does. So. And that explains why in this picture you should expect to see everything scale by, if you scale by delta in this direction, you should expect to see every feature you look at scale by what appropriate factor. You know, if you're looking at an energy, it should scale by j. If you're looking at some length, it should scale by alpha, etc. And actually, there's also a scaling cross here, which... so let me see. I just don't want to get out of order. Yeah, I think that's good. Yeah. So every feature that you look at will scale with various scaling exponents. So I wrote a paper about this in 1991. Specifically in the Frankel contour of a context. So, for example, you know, the sound speed for the critical chain scales with distance from the stable manifold to some power, and the elasticity of the chain, and everything you might want to know about scales with some power. Aubrey with Peyrard had numerically determined some of the exponents. A lot of them dropped straight out of my thesis work, and others required a bit more work. So here are masses of non-trivial exponents, plus, you know, relations between exponents. A lot of, you know, a lot of relations are obvious once you've understood the picture, just as Michael was saying. You know, as soon as you know something scales with something and something scales with something else, then... So, you know, the sound speed is fairly obviously... The exponent is fairly obviously something to do with elasticity and the phonon spectrum scaling exponent. And things like that. So I was able to correct some of Aubrey and Peyrard's conjectures that were wrong based on this picture and explain where all their numerical exponents came from. So what's the next step? That's minimum energy renormalization. So the next step, as I looked at, well, there's an intermediate step, but I'm going to do it afterwards. Turns out to be better, is classical statistical mechanics. Renormalization. So here we're interested in partition function, integral over all the xn's and the pn's of e to the minus beta h. I decided not to use beta because originally I used beta as one of my scaling exponents, so I was worried. I actually wrote j as alpha times beta. So I was worried I'd end up confusing using beta twice. So I'm avoiding writing beta, I just write 1 over t, which is a good idea because I'm only going to get something interesting at low temperature anyway. So it's good to be working around t is 0 instead of beta is infinity. Okay, well, the integral with respect to the p's separates because it's Hamiltonian has the separable form. So that just gives the usual square root of m times t factors. So that's not interesting. So the interesting part is the configuration partition function. And we can do the same decimation scheme on this. So maybe I'll take a new board. Oh, I was going to explain this. Yeah, that was one thing I forgot to do up here. Right, so I get a scaling this way. And the scaling that way is something I called eta, which is equal to minus j over golden ratio. Okay, so the way that these rational tongues accumulate on this point is non-trivial, given by this exponent. Yeah, so actually it's just this point. So it looks as if we have, it looks as if it should be codimension 1, right, instead of codimension 2. But that's because there's actually this other unstable direction when I... I should have drawn... Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you like, what I really did in this picture was cheated slightly, so I controlled some parameter here so that the physical minimum energy mean spacing was still going to be one over golden ratio. So what I was the point of this is then I said, oh, I can relax it, and I'll get a new unstable direction. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a more mental question. So you have the golden ratio appearing there in that diagram at the place where these tongues accumulate, and on that board you have it as some entering your scheme for the information. Why do
Well, I chose to do this deformation scheme precisely because I'm interested in this curve with mean spacing one of golden ratio. If I choose some other irrational, then I have to worry about its continued fraction expansion. So the deformation scheme, so I'm doing the simplest case where actually the continued fraction expansion is constant.
And everything goes through with just more elaboration.
Yeah. That's believed, yeah. So this picture is more complicated. Instead of a fixed point, you'll have to hop around in a way that depends on the partial quotients in the continued fraction expansion. And it may not work very well if the partial quotients go to infinity. Right? So if you have the integers in the continued fraction expansion, if you allow them to go off to infinity too fast, then it may not work very well. So the simple fixed point, actually, even for all diophantine, so this paper of Kochik, who's here, I don't know if I pronounced your name correctly, who has studied that. Yeah? How do you say your name? Kotzisch, okay. Yeah. Aubrey. Yeah, it doesn't need, it's nothing to do with renormalization. Of course. No, it can be quite, let me just have to reflect. Yeah, I better not answer, but Lipschitz, at least. Maybe it's better. Yeah. Lipschitz, but in particular near this point, it's not smoother than something, right? Because the ratio of exponents, right? So I had exponent eta this way and delta that way. Then, unless there's some accident, it's not going to be smoother than log of the ratio of the logs of these. Right.
And this delta is critical exponent. That will depend upon the irrational you chose.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
If it's golden, then if I have a continued fraction of 1, I get 1 exponent. So if I have a continued fraction of 2.
Yeah, something else.
I will get a different
one. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then we'll tidy up. Well, so what you're saying is the mechanics, but the catalyst is all the way up.
Yeah.
It's really around the
symbol. Yeah. Yeah.
But then the irrational sequence way all the way through.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so if you want to go, I'm restricting attention really to golden ratio for simplicity, but, you know, the simple fixed point generalized to a simple line, if you want to study all rotation numbers, you can sort of view it as a square, but anyway, a line is enough. And then you have some counter set of invariant counter set under renormalization, where you have a set of different renormalization operators depending which partial quotient you want to strip off the continued fraction. But yeah, I don't really want to get into that direction because it's an unnecessary complication, at least at the level of what I want to describe here. So let's do the classical statistical mechanics picture. So this is something I wrote in 94, at least it was published in 94. And so what we're going to do is decimate the configuration space partition function. We'll just integrate over selected sites. We have to do e to the minus some h of xn minus 1 xn plus h of xn xn plus 1 over t. That's it. And we're going to write that as e to the minus something, and I'm going to call it h, plus with a sub t on it, plus h of xn minus 1, comma xn plus 1, over some t. Oh, it's the same t at the moment. Okay, so I've defined this plus sub t operation. And as before, we choose our decimation Fibonacci decimation scheme. So we're only going to generate two types of bonds. And what we get is renormalization on pairs of bond energies. But now we're not free to do this scaling in energy, because if we have a non-zero temperature, then temperature is a scale in energy. So the way I think about it is I'm going to normalize my bond energies to some absolute, some value of energy, right? So the value for some, say, 0, 0 is some particular value. And I'm going to take out the scale of the energy as an extra factor, which I'm just going to call T, right? So that probably doesn't surprise me. So I'm going to have J, I do my upsilon plus T tau alpha inverse, minus constants and co-boundaries. Upsilon is J tau alpha inverse. And I'm going to get a new energy scale, T, twiddle, which is some function of the original temperature and the pair of bond energy functions. Okay. So now the thing is, suppose we expand this plus T operation near T is 0, then essentially this probability distribution is just going to pick out the minimizer with some curvature term of integration. Curvature term of integration doesn't really affect much what happens. So you can see pretty fast that we're getting essentially this gives that we have a fixed point. So I didn't give it a name, but anyway, I call this upsilon fixed point as upsilon star tau star. Fixed point upsilon star tau star, and zero for the energy scale, or temperature, T. This is our third component. And, well, let's think about what unstable directions it has under renormalization. It's got all the ones we've seen so far. Plus, it's got the same unstable direction, plus, well, there's obviously an expansion in the temperature direction. And that's eigenvalue, just an eigenvalue J in T positive direction. Yeah, temperature zero is unstable. But this means that we can deduce some scaling laws for what happens to systems that are near this deepening transition as functions of temperature, as well as everything else. Right, so the sort of picture that you can expect, we'll have this natural length of springs parameter. We'll have a parameter that corresponds to ratio of amplitude of the strength of the periodic potential to the springs, and we've got our temperature direction. Okay, so the curve that we had before with its deepening transition is something like this. And so we know we have scaling delta this way, and we have eta across it, and we get a new one like this for turning on temperature. So in particular, suppose there's something interesting like a Schottky anomaly in specific heat. So I draw some surface over here, maybe. Right? We expect Schottky anomalies when K is large. That's from a paper of Aubry and some others. So I draw it as if it's a surface. Of course, really, it's a fuzzed out thing. But anyway, there's some region in our parameter space where specific heat is big. Hierarchical melting, right? So it's where the decimation rule somehow is going to start failing at some order. So if there's a Schottky anomaly here, well, there has to be another one. If we shrink everything by J in temperature, delta in K, and eta in A. So we'll get a picture we deduce just from knowing one Schottky anomaly that has to be a sequence of them. So I've drawn this badly, but anyway. Schottky. Mm-hmm. An anomaly in specific heat, yeah, so a high, relatively, it's not an infinite peak, it's just some bump in specific heat, due to melting of this Fibonacci structure of the chain. That's the way to think of it, right? So the ideal chain is infinitely renormalizable by this deformation scheme, but when we go to non-zero temperature, then everything after a certain level in the deformation has got melted, so you can't still say that you've got bonds which are of this type and bonds which are this type.
It's where what, the classical and the temperature sort of change over, or what?
You would really think of them as arising in a quantum system.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I mean, essentially, it's a bump.
Yeah. Yeah, so if we just choose parameter here and look here, then look at the specific heat. Specific heat is some bump associated with hierarchical, well, associated with melting at some level in this. Okay, so the first one I choose would be just for the top level of melting. And what I deduce is hierarchical melting from this. Okay, so this sort of consequence you can get from the classical statistical mechanics renormalization picture. So then the next thing is actually, in order to understand something about the quantum statistical mechanics, then I have to go back to the minimum energy context, but allow time dependence, right? So minimum energy renormalization was just looking at equilibrium states of the Hamiltonian system. But it has a p squared over 2m, we should allow some time dependence. So there's something I call slow motion renormalization. Not yet. Yes. Well, it turns out I'm going to need something I noticed in the 1991 paper where I allowed time dependence in the classical context. As, you know, experts, even maybe non-experts in quantum statistical mechanics know, that's what I'm going to need some analog of. Yeah, so this is slow motion renormalization. So, here I'm going to do the simplest case. I have a slightly more sophisticated version, but so let's suppose that x n of t move with t, are, but let's suppose they move adiabatically, meaning that at all times the energy is still instantaneously minimized for each particle given the state of its neighbors. So that says H2, this is partial derivative with respect to the second argument, plus H1, the other side, is zero for all t. Okay, these are functions of t. And xn of t is just going to choose itself to be at the instantaneous minimum. That's what I'm calling this adiabatic slow motion. Well then, yeah, I'm running out of time, so maybe I'll just skip ahead. But this is going to introduce a renormalization on the masses, right? We started with a diagonal mass matrix, just m's all down the diagonal. It's going to produce a tridiagonal mass matrix of a special form. The masses, the components of the mass matrix, will depend on the configuration, but they only depend on the configuration of where the xn and the xn plus 1 are and the xn minus 1 in a certain way. So we get that so our renormalization under this adiabatic assumption implies a renormalization for the mass matrix. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the inverse mass matrix. Renormalization for the mass matrix. Right, so the point is, we started with a sum of, I'm going to write as a half m xn dot squared. This is going to turn into something where we have a tridiagonal matrix, x, m, x dot, m is tridiagonal, but also depends on the x's. But it only depends on them in a limited way. And the way it depends on them is this. So we think about what is the contribution of the mass for, okay, so if you like, the mass matrix is the function of position, and it takes values in the space of quadratic forms on velocities, right? So it's essentially a position-dependent quadratic form. So I'm going to write m of psi is a sum of things which I call nu and mu, depending which type of bond we're at. These are functions of xn, xn plus 1, quadratic forms on the psi's. And we get a renormalization on these nu's and mu's. So nu twiddle, mu twiddle, evaluated at an x, x prime, quadratic form applied to psi, psi prime, is j over alpha squared, mu of x over alpha, the intermediate point over alpha, applied to, maybe this isn't very interesting to write, but anyway, here's some intermediate velocity that you have to determine to minimize something, plus nu, same sort of thing. Okay, and mu twiddle is similarly going to be a j over alpha squared times nu that's composed with an alpha inverse. So the question is, how does this mass matrix renormalization behave? Yeah, I get some reduction to this form, right? I don't leave the space of thing of where the energy, if you like, still has the form of kinetic plus potential because of the adiabatic assumption. If I want to do this better without imposing the adiabatic assumption, then I will leave the space of energies which are of the form of kinetic plus potential. And I'll have to think about the energy of curves as functions of time, of states of Frankel-Kontorov models. And I will end up doing a renormalization on functionals of, in fact, pairs of functionals of pairs of curves. And that's what I really need to do. But I'm just describing the simplest case because, well. So here already there's a mystery. Okay, so we know that mass matrix is positive definite, and this operator is positivity improving. So we know it's going to have a let's put ourselves at the critical fixed point for the upsilons and taus. We know it's going to have a positive eigenvector with biggest positive eigenvalue. So numerically I had a look and I found, forget eigenvalue, something I call, now I called it something else in the paper, but called it epsilon squared. So this epsilon squared is something which I probably forgot to write down. Oh no, here it is, 2.72 or something. So under renormalization, the mass matrix grows at this rate. So in particular, one consequence of this is if we look at the phonon spectrum, for example, as a function of the parameter k in the Frenkel-Contour model, so this is going to be omega phonons, then down here we have quasi-periodic KM theory, if you like. So there's some nice spectrum, continuous spectrum, and you can label everything by wave vectors, block wave vectors. It's not this k. This k is the parameter. But then above the depinning, you get a phonon gap. And because of the mass matrix scaling like this, then I predict that the phonon gap scales like whatever it should scale like. Okay, and there are various other things that scale as a consequence of this. So that's why I introduced this in the early paper. This is still a mystery. I don't know where this number comes from in terms of anything else. All right, so I don't know where delta comes from, but that's allowed to be just whatever it is. All right, it's just eigenvalue of something at a fixed point. But eta, for example, I understand what that is. Right, j is just the value of something at the fixed point, so I know that has a right to be what it is. But I had the feeling that epsilon squared ought to be something that I could deduce from everything else, but I can't yet.
But not as an eigenvalue.
Right.
Something simpler, right?
Yeah. So here, of course, it pops out as this Perron-Frobenius eigenvalue. So you could say, well, that's okay. That's just what it is. But I have the feeling that maybe it's related to something else, but maybe not. Anyway, so yeah, what shall I do for the quantum statistical mechanics? Maybe those who know can see where I'm going. And those who don't may be lost already. But should I just briefly sketch what... Since I'm not confident in the conclusion, it's probably not even worth specifying the conclusion, but at least I can say how it could get started, and then... All right. Oh, yeah, there's also quantum ground state renormalization, but I'll skip that as well. So here we get to a quantum statistical mechanics renormalization. So the quantum statistical mechanics of a Hamiltonian of the standard form right, so x and p are in cotangent vector in some manifold at temperature T and Planck's constant H, according to Feynman, I guess it is. I've never figured out a reference for this, but anyway. Aubrey told me this. When I showed him my classical paper, he said, oh, you can probably do the quantum case. So he said, well, there's this correspondence. Right? So it's the same as classical system mechanics of an elastic loop. So I'll write the loop as some function x from circle into our manifold. Ah. If you could give me the reference after, that'd be great. Thanks. So, Okay. So, I'm scaling here. I'm scaling the length in this parameter to 1. Right. So I think it's usually stated with length beta h cross, but at temperature T. So it's usually stated with temperature Planck's constant. For curly H is functional now of these loops, elastic loops. So we just take integral 0 to 1 of 1 half t over h cross squared, x dot times our NASF matrix times x dot of s, plus w evaluated as x of s, integrated with respect to s. And dot here is d by ds. So now we can look at the partition function for this. And we can decimate that merrily in the same way, right? And the decimation here, just as I said, if we did the slow motion thing properly instead of the adiabatic limit, then we'd end up having to enlarge the space instead of just pairs of bond energy functions and the mass matrix. We'd have to have pairs of functionals on pairs of loops. Right, so we get a bigger renormalization thing here. But it has some limits, just as classical statistical mechanics in the T is zero limit actually was the same thing as we had before. This has some limits. And what we claimed, so we get a renormalization on pairs of functionals of pairs of loops. And so what we claimed, but I'm not totally confident about it anymore, is that there's a fixed point that is the fixed point I've been talking about the whole time, dressed up in this terminology, which sort of corresponds to beta h crosses infinity. That's what this is with Catarino. And it has all the unstable directions that we already know about, plus something for making beta h cross not quite infinity. And that eigenvalue, the new eigenvalue, is this epsilon squared thing. Okay. But then I looked at it and thought, actually, right from the beginning of Nuno Catarino's PhD thesis, then I was thinking about a different fixed point which corresponds to beta h crosses zero. And it was only after a while we sort of discovered that we're talking at cross purposes. But I think they both exist. So I can dress up my original fixed point in this quantum statistical mechanics language and get another one which corresponds, if you like, to beta h crosses zero. This is all at temperature zero, because it has the usual direction for making temperature non-zero. And this one, I think, attracts like epsilon squared, so epsilon to the minus 2. But in preparing for this talk, I lost confidence in both arguments, so I'm not sure what the real answer is, but since I'm out of time, I'll stop there. Thank you.